Hello and welcome to Volume 45, Number 51 of Grapevine, your weekly local news magazine, and welcome to our Christmas special. Brought to you by the Great Yarmouth and District Talking Newspaper Association, this edition is published on Friday the 19th of December 2025. I'm Graham, your presenter, joined this week by all your friends from the Grapevine News teams, but with Dusty, Margaret too, and Julie on news duty. With all the important pre-Christmas news for you, plus, of course, loads of special Christmas bits and pieces from all of Grapevine's familiar voices, and highlights from the James Paget Hospital Choir's annual Festival of Christmas Music. First, we have two birthdays. Yes, it's a special hello for a great day this coming Sunday, the 21st, to Teresa Moyard, and also to Helen Godbolt, celebrating on Saturday the 27th. So, very many happy returns to you both. Yes, hope you get two lots of presents and not just one, which is a real cop-out. Well, it may be Christmas, but the reason we're here is to keep you up to date with the local news, which comes first. After which, we have a positive feast of bits and pieces from all of Grapevine's familiar voices.
Hello, everybody. I've got a very happy story to begin with. A Great Yarmouth woman, a major star on Japanese television. A 100-year-old woman from Great Yarmouth has been a huge hit on Japanese national television for her table tennis prowess. Edna Fletcher had a special reunion with Japanese table tennis superstar Mima Ito at Galston Conservative Club almost 20 years ago after they first met in Great Yarmouth. She first met Mima at Great Yarmouth Town Hall in 2007 when the Japanese youngster was a six-year-old table tennis prodigy in her home country and Edna had just won an over-80s world doubles. Back then, Mima challenged Edna to a match in the presence of the town mayor and the many supporters who attended were left in awe of Mima's talent and Edna's sporting longevity. The challenge was big news in Japan, and since then Mima has risen through the ranks to become number 9 in the world. Mima, now 25, has been in London to play the WTT Star Contender Tournament and took advantage of the opportunity to catch up with Edna. She travelled on the train from London to Great Yarmouth to visit Edna 18 years after they first met in a special reunion broadcast on Japanese national television. Mima then challenged Edna to a second match at Galston Conservative Club with Great Yarmouth Borough Council leader Carl Smith helping to make it happen. Their game ended up being seen by millions on Japanese television on the TBS channel. Councillor Smith said, "I was more than happy to facilitate them. I met up with the young girl and her mum. This Japanese crew were following her wherever she went. A really nice story." Edna is still really active with the table tennis group in the Great Yarmouth Table Tennis League. She's as bright as a button for 100 years old. I was really happy to arrange the meeting and for them to have a knock-up of table tennis. In the broadcast, Mima said she was glad Edna was doing well and it was wonderful to see her again. It's a lovely story, isn't it?
Hello everyone, it's Julie and my first report to you is about the Red Devils. So the Red Devils will be dropping into Great Yarmouth to meet sci-fi and comic fans. Next May, the Army Parachute Display Team will be launching itself into next year's Great Yarmouth Comic Con. The event, based around cult television and movies, will see the Red Devils parachute into Great Yarmouth Racecourse on May the 30th and May 31st, weather permitting. The team was established in 1964 and has been the official British Army parachute display team since 1979. Philip Wellesby, organiser of the Great Yarmouth Comic Con, said, "As far as we are aware, they have never been to Yarmouth before. It is a major coup for the event. They normally only attend very large events. It is a really big coup for us. I think it is a really great thing for the town as well. It will be a one-off. The chances of them coming again is very small, really. They will parachute in both days and have a good ground crew. People can talk to them about what it is like to be part of the Red Devils and the Army. The annual event attracts star names, and last year, Alec Utergoff from Stranger Things and Gemma Redgrave from Doctor Who attended. A previous event also saw Doctor Who Time Lord legend Colin Baker materialise in the town, along with Christopher Biggins. The event has invited 3 cadet groups to come along, and if any more cadet groups would like to get involved, they can contact Great Yarmouth Comic Con on Facebook. Next year will be the 7th year of the event, and tickets are discounted until the end of the year. You can get your tickets online at gycomiccon.co.uk and follow the links to tickets. That's gycomiccon.co.uk. That's all lowercase. Hope you can get along. It sounds like a good fun place to be.
Yes, hello everybody, it's Margaret here. And I start with objection to a 500-home Galston plan. NHS bosses have intervened over plans to build 500 homes in Galston, warning hospitals and other services will be unable to cope with the increased demand unless there is more funding. The Norfolk and Waveney Integrated Care System, in brackets ICS, says it will object to the scheme in Lynx Road, Galston, unless the developer can pay £500,000 to support healthcare in the area. Norfolk County Council's company, Repton Property Developments, wants to build the properties in conjunction with Lovell Homes, including a 70-home extra care facility. It's estimated this could grow the population in the area by 981 people. There are already concerns surrounding the extra traffic it will bring to the area. But now NHS officials are warning it will push already stretched services to the brink. In a report, the ICS said James Paget Hospital's bed occupancy rate is already at 95%, while nearby East Coast Community Care is at 98%. It said, "If we are unable to secure these contributions and expand our estate infrastructure, then the impacts would be unsustainable, and the ICS would have to object to the proposed planning application." Health bosses have requested Repton Property Developments to pay £506,355 to help fund additional floor space within the estate to manage the population growth and provide adequate access to healthcare services. The scheme has already proved controversial with people living nearby. Bradwell Parish Council has objected to the scheme, stating the impact on the village is significant. but the developer says the scheme will deliver new homes, for which there is a recognised local need, and argues it can be built with no adverse impacts. Councillors are expected to make a decision on the proposals in spring next year.
Royal Mail postbox closures. Everyone has their own traditions at Christmas, be it watching their favourite festive film or sitting down to the King's speech. But for Royal Mail, people are wondering if its new favourite pastime is to annoy its customers and deciding to close dozens of postboxes across the county to install new technology. People affected by the closures, which have appeared without warning across Norfolk, have called the situation ridiculous. It has left people with cars or mobility issues worrying how they will send cards to their loved ones with just so few days left before the big day. People from Galston, Taverham, Great Yarmouth and even Derbyshire have all been in touch to complain. They worry that the elderly will be particularly affected, and others have questioned why they could not keep them in operation until the day they were due to be replaced. Several postboxes have been taped off with black bin liners put over them, some for several weeks. They are to be replaced with, I quote, postboxes of the future. Royal Mail says it will be the biggest change for the facilities in 175 years. The company is currently rolling out updated designs that will allow customers to send and record parcels and return them up to the size of a shoebox. A solar-powered barcode scanner will open a drop-down drawer to place parcels that would not fit through the traditional slot. The slot will remain in place. It follows that stamps with barcodes are being introduced in February 2022 as part of Royal Mail's modernisation of its systems. Royal Mail has refused to respond to questions about the postbox closures and did not provide a list of where postboxes will be shut before Christmas. A spokesman for the company has previously said, "Oh, our new postboxes of the future offer another convenient way for customers in Norfolk, Lowestoft and elsewhere to access Royal Mail services alongside home delivery and collection, our customer service points, post office branches, lockers and the Royal Mail shop outlets." It remains unclear when the rollout will be completed and whether the affected postboxes across the county will be back in action before Christmas or not.
A changing places toilet has been opened at Great Yarmouth Railway Station. The specialist facility is part of a wider station upgrade by Greater Anglia, delivered in partnership with the Wherry Lines Community Rail Partnership and Muscular Dystrophy UK. It is designed for people with complex needs who cannot use standard accessible toilets, and includes a changing bench and hoist. Rebecca Richardson, Accessibility Manager at Greater Anglia, said, "I'm delighted that we have been able to install a changing places toilet at Great Yarmouth as part of our station upgrade project, which will provide more people with the confidence and opportunity to travel by rail. We want to make sure that everyone can have a good journey with us and can travel with confidence and dignity. So this is a really positive step. We look forward to bringing more of these facilities to other stations on our network, where possible in the future." The project was supported by funding from the Department of Transport. Andy Fletcher, CEO of Muscular Dystrophy UK, said the new facility would make a real difference to passengers from the neuromuscular conditions and other disabilities. He said an estimated 250,000 people across the UK are in need of a changing places toilet. The new facility will allow people to have an accessible journey that otherwise may have been excluded. Additional improvements to the station include upgrades to the waiting room and existing toilets. Martin Halliday, Development Officer of Community Rail Norfolk, said, "The Wherry Lions are pleased to have partnered with Muscular Dystrophy UK to co-fund the creation of a much-needed changing places toilet facility at Great Yarmouth Railway Station. The partnership also welcomes ongoing upgrade work by Greater Anglia to existing toilet and waiting facilities at the station, which complement a number of improvements and initiatives funded by the Wherry Lions CRP in recent years."
The local MP has sparked a war of words online after criticising a scheme that gives councillors money to support community causes. Robert Lowe and his Great Yarmouth First Party called for a 2,000 ward bursary given to Great Yarmouth councillors to be scrapped and for more transparency over where the money goes. Instead, he said the total, £78,000, should be used to keep council tax down, which would actually equate to a reduction of less than a pound for people in the borough. The backlash to the scheme, which aims to give councillors a small pot of funds to support local causes in the ward they represent each year, has angered Mr. Lowe's political rivals. The millionaire businessman who donates his MP salary to charities of his choosing said, "Why not let taxpayers keep their money and choose who they donate to rather than councillors deciding? Will you now commit to publishing every donation to every organisation made with Great Yarmouth taxpayer money?" Daniel Candon, a senior Conservative councillor, said Mr. Lowe's comments amount to a witch hunt. He said, "What the MP is now dressing up as a concern is actually a standard ward budget which every councillor receives. It exists for a simple reason. Ward councillors are grassroots representatives who actually know their communities, their groups, and where a small amount of support can make a real difference. Helping our community groups is not the problem. The problem is a politics that would rather sneer from a distance than stand alongside the people doing the work. What really matters more? Someone with millions always harping on about giving a fraction of it away, or people with very little who give their time, energy and heart to their home community every single day?" Great Yarmouth Labour Group also responded to the criticism online. A spokesman said, "We've been astounded by the interest from so many people from so far away from Great Yarmouth as to how we spend this money locally, to places such as Torbay, Cannock, Billericay, Walsall, to name but a few. We are open and transparent about where the ward budgets go and who benefits."
An extraordinary meeting has been called in to decide the future leadership of the Broads Authority. Dr. John Packman announced his retirement as chief executive earlier this year, sparking a hunt for his replacement. His successor is due to be decided at a crunch meeting held at Yare House on December the 19th. It is not known when the successful candidate will be announced publicly. It follows months of internal discussions to find Dr. Packman's replacement, who steered the direction of the Broads Authority for a quarter of a century. A short list of applicants has been whittled down to a selection of front runners, and a panel of members will decide who takes over the position. Announcing his retirement, Dr. Packman called the role one of the best jobs in Britain and said he loved the lengthy period he spent overseeing the management of the Broads. Once appointed, the new chief will likely take over in the new year. Boaters in the Broads will be eager to find out who Dr. Packman's replacement will be. because his tenure has been marked by rising tension between two factions at the Broads Authority, the, in quotes, parkies, those who want the organisation to focus primarily on its national park duties, and, another quote, the navvies, who are more concerned in representing the interests of boaters and navigation. Earlier this year, these tensions led to a row over the process to replace him, with navvies worrying that the panel that will select his replacement was too heavily populated by people with backgrounds in environmental protection. Following the criticism, the Broads Authority decided to also include the chair of the Navigation Committee, Alan Goodman, in the final interview panel. Dr. Pacman, in a wide-ranging interview last month, acknowledged the role of chief executive is one of frequently finding compromises between the competing interests of navigation and the environment. However, he said he did not buy himself into the navigation and parky clash.
People are divided on ambitious council plans to regenerate part of the town in a £100 million scheme. Great Yarmouth Borough Council has unveiled initial plans for a new multi-million pound scheme aiming to transform the North Quay area of the town. The council wants to create a major leisure destination with a multi-screen cinema, a retail centre with about 70 shops, a 100 to 120 room hotel, parking for up to 900 cars, and reconnect the town centre with the waterfront. People in Great Yarmouth expressed mixed views on plans and the impact it might have on the town. Now, Tom Sullivan, 76, a retired factory worker, said, "I think it's brilliant. The more money that is spent, the better." Gordon Bray, 78, a retired offshore steward, said, "Any business has got to be good. It has got to improve the place." Others are less enthusiastic about the plans and doubt the council can achieve its ambitions. Deirdre Nelson, 74, a receptionist, said, "A complete and utter waste of time. It is dead since COVID. It has never recovered." Businesses have also expressed great concern at the plans and the impact it might have on shops in the town centre. Yasmin Harwood, 71, owner of Unique Sweets at the Great Yarmouth Market, said, "We have empty shops. We want people in town. We are dying a death up here. If people get off the train, they are going to head there first. We are all fighting for a living. The council are not doing anything here to help us. There is so much they can do to bring people up again." Stephen Leddington, 28, owner of SJL Butchers in the Market, said, "Putting something like that right there, people will go there. A lot don't use the market as it is. They're not going to come here. One of the big pulls for out-of-town shopping is free parking. One of the biggest problems around the town is parking. The main car park, if they said it was free for an hour, they would come in. They are looking at the small picture, not the big picture. It is a nice idea, but you need to give people a reason to come into town. I am not opposed to it because I understand the idea behind it, but there needs to be other things to incentivize people to come in." The council's chief executive, Sheila Oxby, said the project would complement the town centre and not replace it. The scheme would also create 1,000 jobs in the town.
A demolition of coastal homes began in Hemsby on Tuesday after severe erosion had left them in danger of falling into the sea. One timber-built chalet, used as a second home by a businessman, was knocked down first as part of an operation to remove properties threatened by the advancing cliff edge. It is one of 8 houses built on sand dunes that Great Yarmouth Borough Council was demolishing during the week because of the rapid coastal erosion. On Tuesday, demolition teams created a temporary access ramp using sand from the beach to allow machinery to reach the clifftop homes. Neighbours gathered to watch as the first property was destroyed. Demolition work was set to continue during the week when the homes belonging to Lance Martin and Pascal Rose were expected to be demolished.
In the Night, our first piece from the James Paget Choir. Much more from them later on in the longest Grapevine Extra to date. That, though, is after the second part of this week's news.
A leading local estate agency has partnered with a charity founded by Jake Humphrey to help inspire and support young people. Miners and Brady has joined forces with the TV presenter and podcaster's High Performance Foundation, which aims to provide youngsters with the tools they need to succeed in life. Humphrey, who lives in Norfolk, started the High Performance podcast in 2020, which now has a community of more than 1 million regular listeners. The success of the podcast led to the foundation's launch 2 years ago. Jamie Miners and Alex Brady, founding members of Miners and Brady, said, "We're proud to be associated with the High Performance Foundation, which is founded by leaders who commitment and reputation speak for themselves. We fully believe in their mission of driving mental resilience, since it is a journey that we had to undertake with minimal help. The fact that these resources are out there for free and target children, reaching them at a crucial stage in life when building resilience can shape their confidence, well-being and full potential is unbelievable. The High Performance Foundation is using role models and real-life storytelling to develop young people's mindsets and mental resilience, improve their well-being and strengthen their employability skills for adult life." Chloe Dannett, CEO and co-founder of the foundation, said, "We're thrilled that Miners and Brady have come on board as a partner and are helping us to drive forward our mission to build the mental strength of young people in Norfolk. Their support means that we can help even more young people to develop the confidence, resilience and self-belief that they need through the rollout of Game Plan, our high-impact resources for schools that develop mental strength. Well, that's very commendable, isn't it?
Players from Norwich City's men's and women's team made a special festive visit to surprise young patients in hospital. Seven canaries bearing gifts brought some early Christmas cheer to young patients on the children's ward at the James Paget University Hospital in Galston on Tuesday. Norwich City football stars Emiliano Macondas, Rory McConville, Kellen Fisher, Jacob Wright and Jovan Makama, who hit a brace in the Canaries' 2-1 win over Southampton last Saturday, along with Olivia Cook and Evie Williams from the women's team, donned festive hats as they united to hand out presents to youngsters currently receiving care on the ward. Looking resplendent in the Canaries' yellow and green festive hats, as opposed to the traditional red, the seven players helped to spread a little festive cheer as they wished the children a very Merry Christmas. They were thanked by hospital officials for their time. One of the lucky recipients of an early Christmas present was 3-year-old Oscar Lawrence from Great Yarmouth, who received a canary, squatty, soft toy and a green bobble hat, but he was pleased with that, which he was delighted to try on in front of the players. You can imagine it, can't you? The Canaries are back in action in the Championship this Saturday, December the 20th, away at Preston North End. It's at 12:30 kick-off, so get near your radios, folks.
A man was taken to hospital with serious injuries and another man was arrested after an assault in the town. Norfolk police officers were called to Theatre Plain at around 8:45 on Sunday, December the 14th, following reports of an altercation which left one man with serious injuries. The ambulance service also attended the scene and he was taken to the James Paget University Hospital, from where he was discharged on Monday. A man in his 40s was arrested on suspicion of grievous bodily harm shortly after the incident and taken to Great Yarmouth Police Investigation Centre for questioning. It is believed that another man was involved in the assault, and police officers would like to speak to anybody who may have information or doorbell footage of the area to help the investigation.
A Great Yarmouth binman has been crowned one of Britain's buffest. Raymond Marshall, 34, was one of 12 waste workers chosen to pose for a new charity calendar. People across the sector entered a competition and a panel picked their favourites. The hopefuls were not only judged by their looks, their personality and enthusiasm for the job were also considered. Mr. Marshall features on the September page of the £9.99 calendar. All profits will go to Fair Share UK, which redistributes excess food to people in need. I'm proud to be a bin worker because we're the unsung heroes of the streets, Mr. Marshall said. We keep things clean, fresh, and smelling slightly less like yesterday's curry. Plus, I get to bring some fun to the job as the singing bin man, spreading good vibes and recycling awareness while on the grounds. Mark Hall, waste management expert and co-owner of businesswasteco.uk, added, "Our nation's bin workers don't get the appreciation that they deserve, and this calendar is all about celebrating them." And I do agree with that bit. They don't get the appreciation they deserve, and they do a very difficult job in awful weather, don't they?
Yes, that's true.
That. Bethlehem on the Mag. Bethlehem came to life in Galston as hundreds gathered for a festive event. Around 600 people filled Magdalen Square on Saturday, December the 13th, for Christmas in Bethlehem on the Mag, a free community event hosted by St Mary Magdalen Church. The event features reimagined Bethlehem Town Square, complete with costumed stall holders, traditional crafts and live animals. Oh, my word. Reverend Matthew Price, vicar of St. Mary Magdalene Church, said, "Christmas in Bethlehem on the Mag was about offering something warm, welcoming, fun and meaningful for the whole community. It was wonderful to see so many families enjoying themselves, learning together and engaging with the Christmas story in a hands-on way. We're incredibly grateful to everyone who helped make the day such a success and to all those who came along to be part of it. Visitors enjoyed hands-on activities, including a carpentry workshop, festive cookie decorating, and wool spinning demonstrations. A nativity trail proved especially popular with the children, who searched the square for 6 live characters from the Christmas story, including Mary, Joseph, an angel, a shepherd, a wise man, and a soldier, a Roman soldier. Those who completed the trail received a small prize. Other attractions included face painting, a giant inflatable snow globe, and Santa's grotto. Everyone who visited Santa received a copy of the Nativity story, brick by brick, a creative retelling of the Christmas story illustrated with Lego scenes. That'd be interesting. The event concluded with a live nativity on stage and communal carol singing. The event was organised by St. Mary Magdalene Church as part of its ongoing commitment to serving its community and was made possible by volunteers from both the church and the wider community. Helpers donated their time to create costumes, run stalls and welcome visitors.
More than 7,597 motorists on Norfolk roads were caught over the speed limit by camera van checks in September and October. The biggest speeding hotspot over the 8 weeks was Hopton-on-Sea, where a series of regular checks on the A47 and around the coastal resort and village found 1,007 motorists over the speed limit. Second highest was Thetford, where 824 drivers, 196 in September and 628 in October, were detected to be travelling too fast. The end of the busy summer months saw the total numbers detected slightly down on preceding months at 7,597. Roadside operators by the Norfolk and Suffolk Safety Camera Partnership covered main routes, including the A47 and the A11, as well as smaller routes in numerous towns and villages across the county. The figures do not include those who were caught going too fast on the average speed limits imposed due to duelling work on the A47 or on the A11 at the Thickthorne interchange. Camera vans are often deployed on bridges overlooking the carriageway or in laybys to use video speed monitoring tech. Motorists caught are sent a notice of intended prosecution, but for more serious speeding offences, the police may choose to take cases straight to court.
A nurse who helped a young man with a life-limited condition to marry his partner has been honoured with a special award. Victoria Mansfield, a nursing sister with Great Yarmouth and the Northern Village Primary Care Home Team, received the Making a Difference Award after she coordinated services, managed logistics and ensured the couple had a wonderful day despite it being a very difficult time. Their chief executive, Adele Madin, said, "This was a remarkable act of kindness and empathy, which shows the kind of nurse that Victoria is, and the commitment to going above and beyond that sums up all our staff. Our awards recognise colleagues who have shown particular talent, initiative and leadership, but also give us a chance to thank all our teams for their dedication to serving the people in our local neighbourhoods every single day. The award was one of 15 presented to their staff, as well as its subsidiary companies and partners within the local NHS system, at the social enterprise event held at the Wherry Hotel in Oulton Broad, Lowestoft.
A woman has admitted being behind an arson attack after fire broke out at a home in Freethorpe village near Acle. Rebecca Spence, 32, of no fixed abode, pleaded guilty to arson with intent to endanger life and being reckless as to whether life was endangered. It followed a blaze at a property in Sutton Crescent in Freethorpe in the early hours of July 18th last year. She has been remanded to remain in prison until she is sentenced at Norwich Crown Court on January the 20th.
When the Atkins bought Driftwood, a charming boat shed with accommodation above it, in the popular Broads village of Horning, it offered the prospect of many idyllic summer holidays ahead. Alas, that dream has evaporated after the family from Hertfordshire discovered they cannot get planning permission to allow them to stay in the property overnight. Despite appeals to the Broads authorities and the planning inspectorate, which adjudicates in such cases, they failed in their efforts to overturn the ban. But Mr. Atkins insisted the previous owners had also stayed in and applied for a lawful development certificate, arguing it had been used for overnight accommodation for a decade. This would give the property automatic planning permission, as the length of use in the manor would make it immune to any enforcement. Previous owners, John and Elizabeth Wright from Dorset, submitted evidence to the EA to prove that they had lived in it periodically each year and provided electricity and gas bills to support their claim. But the application was refused by the BA, prompting Mr. Atkins to appeal to the planning inspectorate to overturn the decision. Despite Mr. Atkins' protestations that the boat shed had been used in this manner for a decade, Andrew McClone, the inspector, agreed with the BA and turned down the appeal.
Long-standing hopes to get the notorious A47 Acle Strait duelled have been handed a major boost after the success of a scheme to relocate protected snails along the road's route. Campaigners, who have been battling for decades to get the road duelled, say the results of a project to move the miniature mollusks from dikes along the route mean they are no longer a barrier to duelling. The government would still have to decide to stump up the millions of pounds it would take to duel the road, and planning permission would have to be secured. But council leaders say it is a significant step towards for the scheme's chances. Graham Plant, Norfolk County Council Cabinet Member for Highways, Transport and Infrastructure, said, "I welcome the news that the snails are no longer a barrier to duelling the Acle Strait. While this removes a potential hurdle, there's still a long way to go before we can see a shovel-ready scheme. Great Yarmouth needs this upgrade for safer journeys, reduced congestion and stronger economic growth. Dikes along the 6.8-mile Acle Strait are one of the few habitats of the little whirlpool ramshorn snail, which are on the International Red List of Endangered Species. Because the animals are so rare, they are protected by law. So Natural Highways, the government company responsible for the road, has to ensure that nothing they do to the road linking Acle to Great Yarmouth would endanger them. Efforts have been made to relocate thousands of the snails to other sites, with the success of those moved crucial if the road is ever to be duelled. A project to investigate relocating the snails began in 2015 and the following year 800 snails were moved between two sites in Acle. In 2017 and 2018, thousands more were moved from sites at Acle, Woodbastwick and Castle Marshes near Beccles to Sutton Fen near Stalham and to Beccles Marshes and Shipmeadow Marshes, also near Beccles. Ecologists say that monitoring shows two of the sites which the snails have been located to in Beccles and Sutton Fen now have healthy populations. Of the Sutton Fen relocation, the report said, creating this new population of little whirlpool ramshorn snail in a valley that previously had never supported the species is an important conservation success. The report said the ditches at Acle are deteriorating in quality and are silting up due to cattle pushing vegetation into ditches, with requested and reduced numbers of snails as a result. At Castle Marshes, the population was steady across the survey period, while there are moderate numbers at Woodbastwick. None were present at Shipmeadow Marshes. National Highways has passed the report to Nature and to National England, the government's environmental advisor. It means that should an application to dual the Acle Strait be submitted in the future, the snail study would be included, alongside other environmental assessments, value for money checks and vital financial calculations. If Natural England are content with the ecologist's report into the snail relocation, it makes it less likely that the organisation would object to the dualing of the Acle Strait, at least on those grounds. The organisation effectively blocked the County Council's plans to build the Western Link between the A47 and the NDR west of Norwich because of the presence of protected bats along the route. Work to dual two sections of the A47 from Blowfield to North Burlingham and Easton to North Tuddenham is underway, along with a project to revamp the Thickthorn roundabout on the edge of Norwich. But there was disappointment last year when the government pulled the plug on a revamp of the Vauxhall roundabout on the way to Great Yarmouth. National Highways recently reduced the speed limit on the Acle Strait to 50 miles an hour and installed four average speed cameras. Between 2017 and 2021, there were 54 crashes on the Acle Strait, with 138 people hurt. My friends, that is the end of my part of the news before Christmas comes, and we won't be talking again till, I trust, in the new year. Mm. But what I want to say to you is that, of course, from all your readers and all your staff here, we have every wish for you, for your happiness at Christmas. I want us to remember, please, while we are enjoying ourselves, which is fine, to just stop and think for a few minutes and raise a glass or say a prayer or give a thought to all those who have no homes to go to, no Christmas dinner. I talked to one dear little man in a cafe the other day, and he's got no home, and he was, all he asked for was a woolly hat and a pair of gloves. And I promised him he would have it on Monday. But the point is, if we all just stop and think, and even just give a smile to someone or a thought and a prayer, we've done our best for our Christmas and New Year resolution. And so with that thought in mind, we all wish you a lovely Christmas as best we can. We understand there are those of you who are lonely and on your own, but we want you to know that we are actually thinking about you at that time. Your friends at Grapevine send their love. So I leave you with my little blessing, which I've given you for so many years now. This is what we wish for you and for everyone else. To every hearth a little fire, to every board a little feast, to every heart a little joy, to every child a toy. Comfort for the lonely, shelter for man and beast, and in the immortal words of Tiny Tim, may God bless us, everyone. Happy Christmas, my friends.
Happy Christmas.
Happy Christmas.
Have a lovely time.
That's our duty done to bring you all of this week's news, but we're not finished yet. We've loads of Christmas cheer in Grapevine Extra, but first, some info on what we're doing over the holidays regarding keeping you up to date. Well, next week, for your sins, I'll be bringing you a quick look at any news which has appeared with an online-only version, which we aim to have on the website on Saturday the 27th from about 3 p.m. The following week we'll see another online-only version with Andrew and Alison on Friday the 2nd, where we change to Volume 46, Number 1. Normal service resumes on Friday the 9th of January, which will have the two online versions on the end so that our postal listeners don't miss out on anything important. Right, it's time to welcome Margaret, Andrew, Alison and Andy with their seasonal offerings, plus Desney with a look at the festive TV. Then the three ladies will reappear with their special type of Christmas cheer. All interlaced with more Christmas music from the JPH. Yes, it's time for Grapevine Extra with bells on. Right, let's start with Desney looking forward to Christmas on the Gogglebox.
Now here's a look at the television you can expect to see just on Christmas Eve, Christmas Day and Boxing Day. I'm sure somebody in your family will have the good old Radio Times that covers the 2 weeks and nearly next year by the time you're finished with it. And I couldn't possibly deal with a fortnight's worth, so that's why I picked on these 3 days. And you will find, anyway, that nothing is ever where you expect it to be. Well, you'll see as I read some of these 6:55 on Christmas Eve, EastEnders. Now, that's not an EastEnders time, as far as I know. So remember, because if you are a fan, you're going to miss it if you look for it at 7:30. There's a family film you might want to watch before that. It's one of the original Paddington stories, not the one they've got now that's been made into a musical, but the first one, and that's just called Paddington, and it's from 2014, and that starts at 5:30 on Christmas Eve. At 7:25, it's not going to be EastEnders nearly, it's going to be the Great British Sewing Bee Christmas Special. And on that, you've got Anton Dubek, Lucy Beaumont, Susan Wacoma, she's an actress, and the Gladiator Hammer. And they are to be inspired to make outfits by the 12 Days of Christmas. I'm looking forward to seeing Anton Dubek do a bit of that. 8:25, you've got the Gavin and Stacey finale, which some of you, most of you perhaps, because I think it was well watched, will have seen last year. But it's on again for anyone who missed it from 8:25 till 10 o'clock on BBC One. I'm not sure what's on at 10 o'clock. I only know that the news, the 10 o'clock news on Christmas Eve, is at 10:35. Now let's look at ITV. ITV, Royal Carols Together at Christmas. This is Christmas Eve, and this is 7:25 to 8:40, so in case you were thinking you might catch up with the ITV soaps at 7:30, no. Royal Carols. Together at Christmas, the Duchess of Cambridge hosts a special carol service at Westminster Abbey, supported by the Royal Foundation, to recognise and celebrate individuals and organisations across the UK who've supported their communities this year. And we did look. I got my friend to look at the TV programmes too, and there doesn't appear to be a late news on ITV. So don't expect news at 10. They've got a film that starts at 9:10 and finishes at 11:40. It's got no news either side of it, and that's Love Actually. Well, you have to have that film on at Christmas, don't you? But if you wanted the news, then... well, BBC One, 10:35 is the only one I can offer you. They do have the earlier news, though. Channel 4 has a Christmas special on Christmas Eve of All Creatures Great and Small. I know some of you will enjoy that. That's Channel 4 at 9 p.m. Now to Christmas Day. Christmas Day has got lots of Christmas specials, as you would imagine. And the biggest one is apparently called the Midwife Christmas Special. That's a two-parter. The next part is on the following day, Boxing Day, and I'll tell you more about that in a minute. After the 8:15 till 9:15 Call the Midwife, you'll have other Christmas specials to watch. But if you are around before that, instead of the 6 o'clock news, at 5:30 you'll have Strictly Come Dancing Christmas Special. That's at 5:30 on BBC One. And on that special, there are such people as, I'm not sure how many there are, but these were the only ones that they gave mention to, Scarlett Moffat, Brian McFadden, and Melanie Blatt. EastEnders on Christmas Day is on twice, but it's on at 7:45 and 9:45. And Christmas Day on ITV is 8:15, Bullseye Christmas Special, 9:15, a 1% Club Christmas Special with Lee Mack, and he says the questions are Christmas themed, so there's something to look forward to. If you haven't had enough Christmas, there's plenty of questions about it. And on Channel 4 at 8 p.m, we're still on Christmas Day here, it's the Great Christmas Bake Off, and the contestants in that are former Peep Show stars. There's Olivia Colman, David Mitchell, Matt King, Sophie Winkleman, that's Claudia's half-sister, I believe, and that's the presenters of that programme, yeah, are the same as any normal bake-off. That's Alison Hammond, Noel Fielding, Paul Hollywood, Prue Leith. Right, BBC Two Christmas specials on Christmas Day as well. Got them. Dad's Army, 6 to 6.40, followed by Keeping Up Appearances, 6.40 to 7.30, followed by The Morecambe and Wise Show, The Lost Tapes from 1968 with Michael Aspel. Remember him, newsreader, and other things he presented, didn't he? That's 7.30 to 8.10. And at 8.10, there's more Morecambe and Wise, but evidently not The Lost Tapes. They've been around a while. 8.10 to 9.15, The Morecambe and Wise 1975 Christmas Show. And on that, there is Robin Day, Pan's People, and Diana Rigg. So now we have Boxing Day left. And on Boxing Day, on BBC One, there's a special, fancy that, Would I Lie to You at Christmas special, with David Mitchell and Lee Mack, and in their team, some of the people in their teams are Jules Holland, Helen George, who's already been on in Midwife, yeah, Helen George, and David Williams is also one of the team members. And then Helen George again will be in Call the Midwife at 8.30 to 9.30 for the second part of the story. And EastEnders, oh, there's an EastEnders at 9.30 after Call the Midwife. So complicated life can be at Christmas, can't it? ITV have a Christmas special, well, of The Masked Singer from 7.30 to 9. They've got four celebrities who are completely incognito, so I can't tell you who they are. But with panto legends Sue Pollard, Christopher Biggins, Basil Brush and Leslie Joseph bringing extra clues. And then at 9 o'clock there is, also on ITV obviously, Who Wants to Be a Millionaire with the England rugby star and celebrity traitor Joe Marler and Catherine Ryan as the contestants. Well, I'm sure there'll be something on there that you might like to see, but if you have difficulty in finding it, well, you know, I told you so. They're all over the place, these programmes at Christmas. But if you want to watch television at Christmas, I'm sure you're quite happy to switch on and flick through the channels till you find something you like. Happy Christmas, everybody. And if I don't see you before then, Happy New Year too.
Well, it certainly looks as though you'll not be bored with that lot on offer. Okay, let's have a quick couple of pieces of deathless prose from Margaret.
Right, and these are my contributions to our Christmas edition. Two silly poems, so here goes with poem number one. I made myself a snowball, as perfect as it could be. I thought I'd keep it as a pet and let it sleep with me. I made it some pyjamas and a pillow for its head. Then last night it ran away, but first it wet the bed. Oh dear. Poem number two. Once there was a snowman who stood outside the door. He wished that he could come inside and run about the floor. He wished that he could warm himself beside the fire so red. He wished that he could climb upon the big white bed. So he called to the north wind, "Come and help me, pray, for I'm completely frozen standing here all day." So the north wind came along and blew him in the door. And now there's nothing left but a puddle on the floor.
Well, if they did get you rolling around spitting your sides, let's hope the floor wasn't wet with dissolved snowmen. Right, it's time to welcome Andy to the mic with a heartwarming tale of giving entitled Loaves and Fishes.
And this story is entitled Christmas Loaves and Fishes. It's written by a gentleman called Ranir Maharaj, who's apparently in Toronto, Canada. However, let's get on with it. On Christmas Eve, in homes everywhere, there's a quiet excitement. The festive feeling and the warmth of having family members near brings to mind a Christmas tale I love to relate each year. It's a true story, even though it might sound unbelievable, and it's proof that miracles do happen. A long time ago, there was a group of young people who decided to spread some Christmas cheer. They had discovered there were several children who would be spending the festive holiday in a community hospital nearby. So one of the friends dressed as Santa Claus. They bought nice presents, wrapped them, and armed with guitars and sweet voices, they dropped in unexpectedly at the hospital on Christmas Eve. The children were overjoyed at seeing Santa, and by the time the group was finished handing out presents and singing Christmas carols, there were tears in everyone's eyes. From then on, it was decided they would play Santa every year. The following Christmas Eve, other patients were included in the rounds, and by the third year, the celebration was expanded to embrace some of the poor children in the neighbourhood. On the fourth Christmas Eve, however, after all the rounds were made, Santa Claus looked into his bag and discovered there were a few extra toys left. So the friends mulled it over, trying to figure out what to do with them. Somebody mentioned that there were a few squatters' shacks nearby in which a couple of desperately poor families lived. So the group decided to go there, thinking there were perhaps three families at most. But as they drove over the crest of the hill into this lonely area, and it was midnight now, the shocked group saw a large number of people standing on the side street. Much to their surprise, they were children, more than 30 of them, and behind them were not three shacks, but rows and rows of shabby squatters' dwellings. As the cars drew to a stop, the children came running up, shouting with joy. It turned out they'd been waiting patiently all night for Santa Claus. Somebody, no one could remember who, had told them he was coming, although our Santa had decided only to go there moments before. Everybody was stunned, except Santa. He was in a panic. He knew he didn't have enough toys for all these kids. Eventually, however, not wanting to disappoint the children, he decided to give whatever toys he had to only the youngest, smallest children. When the presents ran out, he just had to explain to the bigger kids what had happened. So, moments later, he found himself perched on top of a car's hood as these 30 or more sparkling, clean children dressed in their best clothes lined up in order of height, with the smallest first, for their moment with him. As each anxious child approached, Santa dipped into his bag, his heart heavy with dread, hoping to find at least one more toy. And by some miracle, he found one each time he dipped. And as the last of the children received a present, Santa looked into the now deflated bag. It was empty. Empty as it should have been 24 children ago. With a sigh of relief, he let out a hearty ho, 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 and bade the kids farewell. But as he was about to enter one of the cars, the reindeer apparently had a day off, he heard a child scream, "Santa! Santa, wait!" And out of the bushes rushed two little children, a boy and a girl. They had been asleep. Santa's heart sank. This time he knew for sure he had no more toys. The bag was empty. He'd seen it himself. But as the out-of-breath kids approached, he summoned up some extra courage and dipped into the bag one more time. And, lo and behold, there were indeed two more presents in the bag. That group of friends, now all grown adults, still talk about this miracle on Christmas morning. They still have no explanation for it, other than the fact it had happened. How do I know so much about this? I was the one playing Santa.
Oh,
Well, Christmas is a time for nostalgia, but very few will remember Christmas 1925. Here's Alison on those days of yore.
Christmas seems to come around more quickly every year, and this is already the 25th Christmas of the 21st century. I wondered what Christmas was like 100 years ago, in 1925. 1925 was the year in which Scott Fitzgerald's famous novel, The Great Gatsby, was published. It portrayed a wealthy section of New York society at the height of the American jazz age, describing lavish all-night parties which often masked decadence or unhappiness. In 1925, the UK was gradually recovering, economically and socially, from the horrors of the First World War. King George V had been on the throne since 1911. Rationing had ended in 1919, and women over 30 had been given the right to vote in 1918. On the other hand, there was high unemployment, so while some families were enjoying a time of prosperity, others were finding it hard to make ends meet. In the 1920s, there was only a short build-up to Christmas, and decorations, including the tree, weren't put up until Christmas Eve. Christmas trees, live ones of course, which were bought from markets, were becoming increasingly popular. The trees were lit possibly with real candles and decorated either with glass, baubles and toys, or with paper garlands, according to what people could afford. Red was the preferred colour for decorations. Wrapping paper was just starting to become popular. There was a choice of paper with red or green holly sprigs on it, but most people still wrapped their gifts in brown paper tied with string. The Christmas stocking was a large sock filled with fruit, nuts and maybe a small toy, depending what the family could afford. Favourite toys were a whip and top, teddy bears, skipping ropes, toy trains and Tinker toy construction sets similar to Meccano. Often, though, children received a useful present, like a pair of hand-knitted socks. The most popular comics were school friend and boy's own paper. As for Christmas food, turkey was popular among wealthier people, otherwise goose, rabbit or pheasant. All food was bought as close as possible to Christmas Day, as few people had refrigerators and freezers were unheard of. The Christmas pudding, or the plum pudding, was made by housewives weeks in advance. But in the 1920s, the Empire Christmas pudding, made from ingredients supplied from countries in the British Empire, such as spices from the West Indies and sultanas from Australia, became popular. However, brandy butter and cranberry sauce hadn't yet reached the UK. Other sweet treats were gingerbread or a tin of sweets or special biscuits. Christmas entertainment would often be family carol singing around the piano. Maybe for some there would be a trip to the cinema, where all the films were silent, accompanied by music played by a pianist in the auditorium. And what about the weather? We all like to speculate about whether we'll have a white Christmas, but they certainly didn't in 1925. Apparently Christmas was exceptionally mild that year, although it had been preceded by heavy snow at the end of November, and a fog in London on the 4th of December that was so dense that day was like night. Merry Christmas to all our listeners.
Thank you.
Well, all this talk makes you thirsty. Time for a drink, I think, and I think Andrew agrees.
With the Christmas festivities upon us, I thought I'd read you a piece about one of the most famous and instantly recognisable products in the world. Now, this story starts at the back end of 1759. The brewery was dilapidated. Arthur Guinness got it for a bargain. In the latter days of December in 1759, he agreed to take the lease for 45 Irish pounds per year, a constant rate that would in theory remain unchanged for the duration of the lease, which was a staggering 9,000 years. Rather a good deal, it seems now, less than 400 years in. Had he, one wonders, provided the refreshments before the terms of the lease were agreed? Had he a premonition that the drink that now bears his name really was very good for you indeed, increasing life expectancy massively and making only a lease of this length sensible? In fact, the lease is used now primarily as a canny marketing device, the brewery having bought the land outright and long since expanded well beyond the original 4-acre site. Interestingly, while Guinness as an alcoholic drink might be associated now with light indulgence, in its original inception, it was actually intended to improve public morals rather than the reverse. At the time, the most widespread alcoholic drinks were gin, whiskey and poteen, a potent, illicit, home-distilled liquor, its name stemming from the Gaelic word pota for pot. A glass of Guinness, then an ale, was a mild alternative, and much healthier, of course, than the unclean water. It was much better for people than gulping down hard liquor. Also interesting, given Ireland's divided history, are Guinness's Protestant connections. The new drink was even christened Guinness's Black Protestant Porter. Arthur Guinness was a Protestant and a Unionist. Catholics would not even be hired until well into the 20th century and were fired if they revealed themselves. Today, the hunt for revenue has banished sectarianism and overlooked virtue of capitalism. Guinness is guzzled much further afield now. 200 million pints are drunk annually in America, and it is virtually the national drink of Nigeria. Arthur's Beer is one of the world's most familiar brands. Now, I'm sure many will remember the famous ads of the 60s and 70s, Guinness gives you strength, and the Guinness memorabilia with the toucans, etc., became very collectible. Modern trends, of course, have now led to the production of a very successful, and I may say very tasty, brew of alcohol-free Guinness, which I'm sure will still be around in 400 years. But Merry Christmas to you all. If you do indulge in a Guinness or two, then cheers. Happy Christmas and thank you for listening.
We wish you a Merry Christmas. We wish you a Merry Christmas. We wish you a Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year.
Well, I did give you advance warning. It's time now for the return of our week's three newsreaders, our resident experts at rabbiting on in perfect harmony. It's Dusty, Margaret Two, and Julie, let loose on a microphone.
Well, hello again, everybody. Here we go with our little bit of reminiscence and nostalgic episode. We love to talk about the old days, don't we, all of us? And I know some of you will come up with some ideas and talk among yourselves. It gives you something to talk about over the Christmas dinner. That is, if you're still awake. Anyway, this is from the Eastern Daily Press series of Harking Back. And Emma, who does all this, takes a light-hearted look at the family traditions around a humble cleaning product. Soap might not seem like a subject to get in a lather about, but it's one of those everyday essential items that to me typifies however complicated our lives have become throughout the decades. We've all used soap to keep ourselves clean. And during the pandemic, we panic bought it by the bucket load as a way of limiting the spread of germs. In truth, she says, the reason that I felt inspired to put this humble cleaning product in the spotlight is due to my cousin Suzanne, recently telling me that she'd been searching for a particular soap for her dad, who was in his late 80s. It had to be a bar, not liquid, and the brand he wanted was Imperial Leather. First made in 1938 by manufacturer Cousins, Imperial Leather is certainly a brand that has stood the test of time. The scent for the soap was initially commissioned in 1768 by a Russian nobleman as a type of perfume. Hence the name, Suzanne said, Imperial Leather Soap always seemed so luxurious as a kid in the 70s, with its regal shape and little gold paper label in the bar. I bet kids were not supposed to use it. The opulent image of the soap was heightened by the TV ads, featuring a wealthy family enjoying a luxury bath, with Imperial Leather, of course, on a private plane. I can't imagine there was enough room for a bath on a private plane.
No,
can you
just wondering
what happens when they pull the plug out.
Yeah, they slip down the hole.
Mind boggles.
It's comforting to know that many of the soap bar brands we had as children are still being made today, including one that my mum, she said, remembers from her childhood in the 1940s. She said, us kids only had a bath once a week, as it was such a palaver, and we all used the same water. I can remember that we had palm olive soap, which dates back to 1898. They were always tarring the road somewhere, and we'd come home with tar all over our knees, so it took a lot of soap to scrub us clean. My mother brought another heritage brand for us when we were kids, Pears Glycerine Soap, which was first produced in 1807 by Andrew Pears at the factory off London's Oxford Street. It was billed as being gentle and kind on the skin and had a translucent quality, much like your skin was supposed to look after using it.
What, orange?
Well, possibly.
Actually, if I can interrupt there, they used to promote that for use with children too, didn't they? And I remember there would be some adverts, which I thought were absolutely beautiful. There was this gorgeous-looking girl there drawing a curtain back, and it said, preparing to be a beautiful lady.
Oh, well.
Prepare soap, yes.
Oh, right.
Yes.
They used the bubbles. I'd
have read that a long time.
Bubbles as well, didn't they?
Yes, I believe they did.
The little boy with the curly hair.
Yes,
mm.
Yes.
Oh, dear. So, anyway, where did I get to with that one?
Pears soap.
That's right.
I never knew whether it was pears or pears.
Oh, it's definitely pears.
Pears,
definitely, yes. Definitely. Mm. Yes. Gentle and kind on the skin. Okay. The product had celebrity endorsement from characters. This is interesting. The product had celebrity endorsement from characters such as socialite actress Lily Langtry. Yeah.
Oh, did she know?
Yeah. And she and the company's advertising posters featured beauties of the day. I bet she had that on when she came to the what do you call it, hotel?
Britannia.
Where'd she come to?
It's somewhere on the front, wasn't it?
Yeah, which is now the
cinema.
No.
No, it was next to the Masonic. Oh, dear.
You throw dice at it, what, all that.
Yes.
Casino.
That's the one, thank you very much.
That was it.
Yeah,
we're just
not
making this up, folks. This is...
I bet she wore that night because she came there with the king, didn't she?
Yes, she did.
Only that she wasn't supposed to have, but they had a nice little liaison there. You know?
Yes,
did you know
right.
that?
Yes.
Well, there were tunnels. There's tunnels underneath she used to go.
Well, that's where they hid, I expect.
The underground.
Oh, dear. Anyway, the company's advertising posters featured beauties of the day. The firm even ran an annual Miss Pears competition from 1958 to 1997, where young girls vied to become the face of the brand for a year. Anyway, that's interesting, isn't it? Now, come on, what kind of soaps do we remember?
My grandmother used to scrap me up with that horrible carbolic stuff.
Did she?
Oh,
dear.
Oh.
No, it's coal tar soap.
Yeah. Oh, that's right.
Yes, that's the one.
Yes.
Spunk like
that.
It
that's the one. And then there was that awful carbolic one.
Oh, yeah,
they had enough smell, didn't it? Yeah,
yeah,
that was red, all right.
Yeah.
Yes.
So were we.
That was rough as guts.
Absolutely.
Yes. So then we had Fairy, didn't we?
Oh, yes.
We've got Fairy.
Doing the clothes. We used to put
that's
on the
it.
Clothes.
That's it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes. Mild green fairy liquid.
But that's the washing up liquid.
That's the washing up liquid, that is.
Oh, no, that's
but
not
mind
right,
you, could put that, I swear they put that on their face. Anyway. Then there was Lux. Do you remember Lux?
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
And Knight's Castile. Remember that one?
Yes, that sounded very grand, didn't it? Knight's Castile.
Box rather than paper, wasn't
yes.
it?
Mm. Oh, yes.
Yes, that's right. And then there was this posh one, Camay, wasn't there? Camay.
It was pink.
And then, of course, there was Lifebuoy, wasn't there?
Oh, there was Lifebuoy.
Oh, my word, yes, there was Lifebuoy. And cold cream and all that. Mm. Imperial leather. Silk. Imperial leather just won the day, really, because it's still around, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. Well, so is pears, isn't it?
Well, I suppose, yes, I suppose it is.
But Imperial leather didn't matter how small the bar got, the little label was still there.
That's right.
Never came off.
No, that's
true. That's what they were sort of attractive, wasn't it?
Certainly, our childhood soap was an Imperial leather, yes.
Then she also wrote a little thing about tasty morsels from time gone by. Readers have been reliving their school cookery classes now. I expect you remember
that, don't
you? Oh, my
goodness,
And my parents.
So she said, following my recent column, Maureen Andrews, who has fond memories, said, in 1955, age 14, I travelled with my housecraft teacher to take part in a housecraft competition. I remember having to make toast, a souffle omelette, followed by baked Alaska. I came third in all of London, having lost points for not cutting the crusts off the toast. I like that. At the age of 84, I still cook from scratch most days, but do cheat occasionally and have a ding meal. Well, we all do that, don't we?
We all do that. Yeah.
Alison Barlow's mother was a cookery teacher between 1960 and 1976. Alison said, the family took with enthusiasm to lessons about nutrition and identifying carbohydrates, first-class animal, and second-class vegetable protein, so that it's a cooked caterpillar found in the cabbage from my father's allotment was held up with, look, first-class protein here as well.
It's before it legged it, yeah.
Yeah, it's quite. It's a great pity that domestic science fell away around the national curriculum was introduced. There's no need to know how to produce a perfect Victoria sponge cake, but a knowledge of how to cook a dozen cheap, tasty, nutritious meals from scratch would benefit everybody, they said. Ruth Harrison recalls her first school cookery lessons. At high school in 1952, she said, oh, we didn't start by cooking. First, we learnt how to scrub the wooden table at the kitchen. Next lesson was making an apron, and it wasn't until that was all finished that we started on a shortcrust pastry. Well, I know that we had to go up onto the attic in the convent and put tea leaves on the floor and sweep the floor up there. And by the time we come down again, we were exhausted, having done that. And also, my pièce de résistance was potato soup. It was about the only thing I could make, really. And I took some scones home to my mother, and I think they landed up somewhere like the dustbin or somewhere like that. You know. But yes, exactly.
Well, our DS room was above the science lab, and you always knew when they were making bread because they used to smash it to get the air into the bread. So every time they were sort of thumping the bread, you knew what they were making when you're down in the science lab because you could hear it. They're making bread again. Yeah.
The lady who talked about DS at the high school, it rang a few bells with me because I was there just a few years later. Not many years later, but I was. And I do recall that one of my efforts was an omelette. When I got it home, the family said it was like a yellow hot water bottle. And I don't know where it ended up.
However, did you get that on the bus?
I don't know. I can't even begin to imagine.
Tin foil. Yeah, well.
But you can't keep an omelette, Margaret. They go like leather.
Well, I know they do. That was why that's described as.
Well, she did it differently, you see, didn't she? You did it differently, didn't you?
DS Day was dreadful because it was Monday. So it was, I had to take my hockey stick and my tennis racket, my violin, and a tin with all the stuff in for DS. Mm. That was interesting.
It must have been.
Yes.
Go on, Dust Wales, if you want.
Well, I've got all sorts of little things, but there's one about the banks now. She was talking about the banks. She says you can't bank on anything, because I was thinking about my little money box, you know. Did you have money box, you did?
Oh, yes.
Yes.
No, I didn't.
And you know, whatever you saved was great. You used to keep tipping it out to see how much you got.
That's right.
You? And she said that she once saved pennies in a jar to be exchanged at the bank, but now our cash no longer seems to be king. When we were children, we always laughed about people who kept cash in tins under their beds because they didn't trust the banks. Nowadays, when it's not only economic downturns and stock market crashes that threaten our hard-earned pennies, but also cyber criminals and scammers. Stashing your cash in a biscuit tin doesn't seem like such a bad idea now. Although, like most people, I have been forced down the route of internet banking. Well, I haven't. And I have much sympathy with the older generation who would not have an online access and wouldn't use it if they did. What they really want is a local branch of their bank that they go into, and I do think that's very important. They're taking them away from everywhere. And they go into and talk to a real person. You know, that makes a lot of difference, doesn't it? And she said that maybe it would be a good time now to rob a bank, somebody said, to which she replied, well, that's if we could find a bank to put it in, which is very true, isn't it?
Yes.
Well, what were your money boxes like?
Well, mine was just like a little pillar box, and I remember that it had a little door on the front that you could open and shut and lock with a little key.
Oh, it locked, did it?
It did, but I wasn't allowed to have the key because I'd got to save up, so the key was heading up.
You don't mean to say you would have taken it out?
Oh, well, say no more. But I can well remember another money box I had in which I'd saved little coins and everything, and it added up to about half a crown. Anyway, for some reason or other, my grandmother wanted this change, and she wanted me to have a half crown. And I didn't want a half crown. I wanted all my pennies and halfpennies and farthings and whatever they were.
Oh, half a crown was a lot of money.
It certainly was. It was. And when I got home from school, I was most affronted to find that all my change had gone and in its place was a half crown. I was not impressed.
You weren't HP,
no,
were you?
I wasn't HP, no.
So what toys did you have at Christmas? What kind of toys?
Oh, well, I suppose, yes, quite a variety of things, really. But the thing that I loved best was my three-wheeler trike, which was, I'm sure it was second-hand from somewhere, but that didn't bother me. I suppose Dad or Grandad had painted it up. And it was actually wheeled into the bedroom where I was sleeping, and when I woke up, there it was. And it was what I had really, really wanted. And I was absolutely delighted with it, and I couldn't wait to ride it. Anyway, I was still in my pyjamas, but the bungalow where we were with my grandparents had a wide hall, so I could ride my bike down the hall. But before I was allowed to sit on the saddle, my grandmother put a fur glove on it so that I wouldn't get cold. And I remember riding it down the hallway, right down into the bathroom. And that was just lovely. Mm. But, I mean, there are all sorts of small, inexpensive items, I suppose, really, you know, by today's standards. I was very, very happy with them, whatever they were.
What did you look for, Julie, mostly?
Well, my parents used to make my toys, which was very special.
Well, your dad was a very clever man, but everybody could do that, could they?
No, he would make anything out of nothing. Mm. He was very clever. But three things I really remember. Mm-hmm. One was a doll's house, which he'd obviously made, and my mother had made all the little furniture and upholstered all the furniture and everything and wallpaper the inside, and that was lovely. And I had a farmyard, which was basically a big half sheet of cardboard, which he'd painted a field on, you know, like a brown field and a green field and a pathway and
so
a pond.
So if you got a cow for Christmas, that was all right, wasn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, well, this is the thing. They bought me some animals, and he'd made like a pigsty and the stables and a little farmhouse and everything. And then they bought me some animals and things and a farmer, and milkmaid with her buckets and stuff. And then other members of the family, every time I had a birthday or a Christmas, used to buy me, like, chickens or a cow or a horse.
Oh, lovely.
It was lovely.
Oh, it must have been.
And I spent hours with
them. Oh, so did I, on the floor with mine.
Yeah, yes. Exactly. Yes.
The little trees.
Yeah, that's right.
And the pond. Mm-hmm. Yeah. The little mirror for
ducks
a pond.
And things.
Oh, it was lovely. I used to play with that for ages.
Yeah. The other thing, and I still got them, actually, was a pair of stilts.
Oh, yes.
And could you use them?
Yeah. Oh, no, they weren't all tall. Well, they were tall to me, but they at the time. But
oh, you managed to master
not
it, did you?
Not compared with them. And they weren't like circus stilts. Mm. They were about a foot or so off the ground.
All right.
And
which, when you're tiny,
that's high, isn't it?
Oh, yes.
And so I sort of stomped around on those, which was, yeah, and I've still got them. I couldn't, when I moved, I found them in the shed, still all painted red, exactly as they were when Daddy made them.
How
and
lovely.
I've got them even now in my shed. Mm. Can't part with them. It's daft, isn't it?
I remember having a Noah's Ark set, which I absolutely loved. I really did, and I played with it a lot.
Did you? But
unfortunately, when Mrs. Noah went missing, and we never found Mrs. Noah, she just
Mrs.
disappeared. I just sort of lost interest in it, really.
Mm.
Yes.
And I wonder where she went off to.
I don't know where she went off to, does Mrs. Noah? Yes.
She got her feet wet wherever she went, I should
She know. Certainly did, yes. Mm. Yes, that's right.
But I always used to look for my... as I told you, my Rupert Bear annual, that was my first thing. And then I always wanted my... we always used to get an album of the comics, you know. And my best one, of course, because I used to have the Dandy, and it was Dangerous Dan and all that, and he used to eat a lot. I used to love that, and look for that as well. And I always loved poetry books or anything like that, even when I was little. But Emma has written here about remembering childhood books, and she said that readers have fond memories of their childhood books, including Louise Adams, who enjoyed, and I guarantee this was a good one, The Magic Faraway Tree. That was Ina Blyton, wasn't it? Mm. And Sunny Stories. Do you remember Sunny Stories?
Sunny Stories, yes.
Yeah?
Yes.
And she said, I always loved Millie Molly Mandy and was enchanted to learn that our dear Aunt Jean, a child in her late 20s, had loved her too. Also beloved of my own daughter, who became a primary teacher and introduced it to various classes, including one in Rome. So Millie Molly Mandy, Billy Blunt and little friend Susan became the childhood companions of quite a few little Italian children too. Isn't that nice?
Mm, lovely, isn't it? Yes.
And Sarah Slade's dad read The Jungle Book to her as a child. What did you have read to you?
As a child?
Mm.
Probably something I couldn't broadcast. Mm.
Really?
Because it involved a tiger running round the tree and turning to butter at the end of it.
Oh, right.
Oh, right. Yes, yes.
Ladybird books. I remember Ladybird books. Yes. And being read to Enid Blyton, the famous farm.
Yes. Oh, I loved...
And The Boy Next Door, I used to love that.
I had all the Enid Blyton series every time they came out, because I wasn't very well in the war, having been shaken up rather badly, because we were on the bus. I think I probably told you this. We were on the bus going to school, and if you remember, well, I don't suppose you do, but a bomb dropped on the Maltings across the way in the halfway house was a pub, wasn't it, on South Down Road?
Yes,
opposite, and that's where the bus stopped, and this damn thing went off, and we all had to go off and lay on the road, and I was really shaken up about that, so I was ill for quite a long while. But my dad, God bless him, he was the one who helped me to read properly. He bought me a book every day while I was ill, so I could, and oh, I did love it. And one of my favourite books was you talk about The Faraway Tree, but there was also The Land of Far Beyond. Now, you might think that reading Bunyan's Pilgrim Progress was quite a chore, and it was, but this was Enid Blyton's take on Bunyan's.
Oh, yes.
Yeah,
yes.
And it was lovely, and so I got to know things like classics easily.
Yes,
which was
lovely.
And of course I loved the Arthur Ransom, you all about the Broads.
Oh, yes.
You know.
Yes.
And all that kind of stuff. So I was very blessed. And my dad used to read to me every night, and it was usually Just William's stories, and they were lovely.
Oh, they were lovely, lovely. Yes. And weren't they lovely when they were broadcast in
Children's
Hour, too?
Well, because that was Jarvis. Yes. He got the voice like Andy.
Absolutely.
Marvellous.
I think the first proper book I was ever bought was Wind in the Willows.
Oh, yes.
And I still got that.
That's
copy.
Another beautiful one. Mm. That's amazing what you can do with Wind in the Willows. I've even got a book that someone's written and made like little parables of it, so you can do it if you use a sermon. You can do. There's so much in Wind in the Willows, isn't there? Mm. You know, the Gates of Dawn and that kind of thing. That's it can be translated into Christian sort of things, as well as myths and that kind of stuff. But no, very, very blessed we were to learn to read, I think. So anything that you would like to reminisce about? Or?
Right, so this little poem that I'd like to read to you is called What the Donkey Saw. So we have to remember it's from the point of view of the donkey. And the donkey says, no room in the inn, of course, and not that much in the stable. What were the shepherds, Magi, Mary, Joseph, the heavenly host, not to mention the baby, using our manger as a cot? You couldn't have squeezed another cherub in for love nor money. Still, in spite of the overcrowding, I did my best to make them feel wanted. I could see the baby and I would be going places together. I think that's a lovely little poem.
That's a beautiful poem.
Yes, by U.A. Fanthorpe.
Right, well, this piece I got to read to you is called Christmas in Perulia. And it's about a fellow who was working as a superintendent in the Perulia Leprosy Home and Hospital in West Bengal in India. Now, most of this development was without electricity, and there was a small and erratic electricity supply in Perulia town, but it was functioning at its limit with old generators. And he says, we were too far out of the town anyway. It would have been too expensive to pay for several miles of posts and overhead wires to the hospital. But it was hard running a hospital without it. There was no power for X-ray machines, only hurricane lanterns in the wards and the pressure lamps in the operating theatres and elsewhere. Then came a state government project bringing power for a new dam built 40 miles away. We watched with growing anticipation as the line of pylons gradually snaked its way across the fields. It passed less than a mile from the hospital, and after battling through the morass and the red tape, we were able to make a connection. It made a great difference, proper lighting everywhere, power for the X-ray, air conditioning in the major operating theatre, and much more. Now, we all staged a nativity play at Christmas, and it was joint effort by staff and patients, adults and children. And when our first Christmas with electricity came, we decided to play would be the biggest and best we'd ever put on. It would be out in the open air, and in the evening we could make full use of the new lighting. We built an earth stage on a wide stretch of flat ground and erected a makeshift arch over it, all bamboo and jute sacking. We made footlights out of old kerosene tins and lined them across the stage. In the planning group, someone said, as it's outside, let's have a real fire for the shepherds to sit around. It was a great idea. That began to expand under its own impetus. What about the sheep? Well, that was easy. We could borrow a dozen from the nearby village. We've got sheep everywhere around here. And although we didn't recognise it, that's where the trouble began. In rehearsal, the sheep began to stray, looking for food. We chopped up straw for them and spread it around on the ground. They ate it quickly
and strayed some more. Then came another idea. Let's tie a string round the necks of the sheep and each shepherd can hold two or three of them. And the strings won't be seen in the dark. It seemed to work. Now you have to bear in mind that these shepherds were children, you know, with the compulsory tea towels round their heads and things like that. They weren't adults, they were children. So my idea was the one that did it, actually. Near the stage was the central kitchen. It had a flat roof, and I suggested that we put a ladder against the far side of the kitchen. The angels, all children in white robes and silver wings, would climb up quietly in the dark and line up on the roof edge. At the right moment, we could switch on the floodlights, kept in reserve for the occasion. The angels would appear as though flying through the dark sky, the stars behind them. It was high drama. Came the evening of the play, and the air was taut with excitement. Almost all the patients gathered, Hindu, Muslim, Christian, and the staff were there in force, and so were the folk from neighbouring villages. There was just one thing we hadn't taken into account in our planning, and that was the sheep's reaction when the lights suddenly flashed on and the angels appeared from nowhere. The stage was flooded in light, and so was the heavenly host. Baa went the sheep. Fear not, shouted the angels from on high. Baa went the sheep. We bring you great tidings of great joy, shouted the angels, in Bengali, of course. Baa went the sheep, and one, even more terrified than the rest, backed into the fire. Its tail began to burn. It bleated once more, jumped about a foot into the air, wrenched its string from the shepherd's restraining hand, and leapt into the dark. All the other sheep followed. Within seconds, there were a dozen panic-stricken sheep dashing through the audience of 1,000 people sitting cross-legged in the dark. It was pandemonium. Some made valiant attempts to catch the sheep, grasping wildly at living legs of mutton as they dashed by. It was in vain. It took us almost 24 hours to track down the last sheep. I don't remember
how we... The last sheep or the lost sheep?
Indeed. I don't remember how we finished the play. It wasn't the best nativity play we ever produced, but it was the one we will all remember.
I thought
I'd share that with you.
That's lovely. You can just visualise it, can't you?
You can, yeah.
No room at the inn, get clear off, no. So on this occasion, the little fella who was playing the innkeeper, poor Joseph, said, "Me, please, may we come in? Well, we're really so tired and everything." Say, "Of course, come in, mate. I'll make you a cup of tea."
Oh, lovely.
He's talking about his mum. Yeah.
Talk about how to kill it without really trying. You know?
Well, I was telling the girls this yesterday. I read a thing about children's nativities, and so they were all in their tea towels and shepherds in tea towels and their little angels with their tinsel and their silver wings and everything. And the teacher had said to them all, as you go up onto the stage, I want you to say something to the baby Jesus. So they all went up and they said something holy to baby Jesus. And then this last little shepherd looked at the doll, which was obviously pretending to be the baby Jesus, looked at the doll, looked up at Mary, looked back at the doll, looked up at Mary, and then said, "Oh, you do look like your mum."
Sweet, isn't it? Yes. I love it.
Oh, dear.
Oh, I love it.
Hey, what you got, Dust?
Well, I have got my poem to read for you.
So if you do your poem, yeah.
Yeah, okay. Right, well, this is John Betjeman. And John Betjeman was a poet laureate at one time. And I think this was written around, well, it was in the 50s and so on. And he was a satirical poet, but also a very serious poet as well, a lovely poet. And he has written here about Advent, 1955. The Advent wind begins to stir with sea-like sounds in our Scotch fir. It's dark at breakfast, dark at tea, and in between, we only see clouds hurrying across the sky and rain-wet roads the wind blows dry.
and branches bending to the gale, against great skies all silver pale. The world seems travelling into space, and travelling at a faster pace than in the leisured summer weather when we and it sit out together. For now we feel the world spin round, on some momentous journey bound. Journey to what? To whom? To where? The advent bell calls out, prepare. Your world is journeying to the birth of God made man for us on earth. And how, in fact, do we prepare for that great day that waits us here? The 25th day of December, the birth of Christ? For some, it means an interchange of hunting scenes on coloured cards. And I remember last year I sent out 20 yards laid end to end of Christmas cards to people that I scarcely know. They'd sent a card to me, and so I had to send one back. Oh dear, is this a form of Christmas cheer? Or is it, which is less surprising, my pride gone in for advertising? The only cards that really count are that extremely small amount from real friends who keep in touch, who are not rich, but love us much. Some ways indeed are very odd by which we hail the birth of God. We raise the price of things in shops. We give plain boxes, fancy tops, and lines which traders cannot sell thus parcelled go extremely well. We dole out bribes, we call a present to those to whom we must be pleasant for business reasons. Our defence is these bribes are charged against expenses and bring relief in income tax. Enough of these unworthy cracks. The time draws on near the birth of Christ. A present that cannot be priced, given 2,000 years ago. Yet, if God had not given so, he still would be a distant stranger and not the baby in the manger. I love that. I love that poem. It's got so much truth in it, so much life, so much. It is what we do. It is truly what we do often. Well, they sent me one. I'll have to send one back. Do I really want to? You've got to get to the bottom of it all, haven't you, really, sometimes, of what life is all about.
Yeah.
And well, I do love that.
Oh,
Well, that's it for this 2025 Christmas edition of Grapevine. It's copyright 2025 of the Great Yarmouth and District Talking Newspaper Association. News content is adapted mainly from the Great Yarmouth Mercury. However, the Great Yarmouth and District Talking Newspaper Association accept responsibility for editorial decisions made for this recording. As I mentioned earlier, the next 2 weeks' editions will be online only, but we will be back in full force on Friday the 9th of January, so we look forward to your company then for much more of your local news. But in the meantime, we wish you a great Christmas and hope that you stay safe and well. So from everyone here at Grapevine, it's bye for now.